Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey, for plugging us in technologically and getting us introduced for the Blog Talk Radio show called Jumbled Justice. I was wondering, Mike, what do you think about Johnny Cash out there on the road now? I've heard here in Ohio, in fact, a politician told me that today, that the speed limit's going to go up to 70. Does that mean it really goes up to 90? I personally think that's a mistake, but... People have pushed for it. People want to drive 85, so they make the speed limit 70. We'll have to see how that one turns out. Does anyone know? Has Ohio actually done that? I'm ashamed to say I don't know, but I should have checked earlier. But anyway, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and to the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I am Keith Haley, the guy that Audrey says I am. And we want to thank Emily and Mike. And, Lucy is back, and she'll have our blonde joke for this evening. And, of course, Audrey, who always does a wonderful job for us on this show. We have a four-person staff, and they do just a great job all the way around. You can't believe that behind-the-scenes things that must go on to create this one-hour show where 14 people listen to. I'm kidding. Part of that, I'm kidding. Purpose of this show is to discuss news and events and issues and developments in this field of criminal justice. There's always something going on until we find some solution to crime, and I don't think we're going to find that. Although crime is down, we like to dispel the myth that people think crime is high. It's the lowest we've had in 50 years, and our homicide rates, in fact, since the 1960s are one half of what they used to be. So people need to know that, I think. This show is dedicated to the tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and the world. We try to take a close-up look at the show. Alan Levy is the CEO of Blog Talk Radio Network. You can have a show in literally probably under a minute. You can sign up, go to blogtalkradio.com, and you can have your own show. You can do it at midnight, 3 in the morning, 6 in the morning, 10 at night. I think if you're 7 to 10, it might cost you money, but those other times are absolutely free, and they can be our shows, I think. I don't know what the longest show is. Do you know, Mike? I don't know either, but anyway. Speaking of interesting people and books and that type of thing, instead of waiting for our book segment, I got a book in the mail yesterday that I ordered, It's the Cincinnati Police History and Images of America, and it's just a wonderful book, and it's written by Christine Mersch with the Greater Cincinnati Police Historical Society Museum. And as you look through this book, it's just wonderful photographs of historical things. And I don't know what you know about the Cincinnati Police, but I worked in the city for 15 years and taught there in the graduate and undergraduate programs, was a chair at the University of Cincinnati. And I was looking through here. I thought I'd only taught four of the Cincinnati Police Chiefs. I've actually taught six over the years, about 15 years' time. But it's a marvelous book, and anybody who wouldn't have any interest in policing would enjoy this. You get to see a picture, for example, of the police tug-of-war team back in the early part of the 20th century. Yes, they used to compete tug-of-war. And Cincinnati had call boxes way back on the with telegraphs. I think they were the first in the nation to do that back in the early 1880s. And then they replaced those, of course, with telephones, but the horse patrols and all kinds of things. But you'd really enjoy that book. Again, it's called Cincinnati Police History. Wonderful photographs, just probably hundreds of men here of all sizes and variety. So policing is an interesting business, and it's had an interesting history. And Cincinnati, of course, was on the front of Life magazine in the late 1960s, whenever, as the model police department for the whole United States. And Cincinnati started a program, a cadet program, where you're 18, you couldn't get a job as a cop because you had to be 21. So what happened was you would become a police cadet. You'd work in the police department for a semester, in other words, a grading period. Then you'd be off for a quarter. You'd go to college. You'd work a quarter, then go to college a quarter, and do that for 2 years, and you got your associate degree, and then you were 21. You went to the police academy, and you became a Cincinnati police officer. And so that's how the department came up with a very well-educated police department, and many of them went through the master's degree program there at the University of Cincinnati. They're really, really fine people, and there's a lot of pictures in there of people that lost their lives in dedication to the citizens of Cincinnati and visitors to that city, too, but the book doesn't focus on that. But one of the front covers, I think, is their dog named Handsome. It was a police dog that one of the officers actually rescued in the middle of the night. The dog was starving somewhere, and it became a police dog for them and actually helped them catch felons. And there's a great part of it, too, in several segments about the African-American police officers in Cincinnati, and I taught some of the early ones that were on that department also. So anyway, take a look at that if you're interested in police history whatsoever. Tonight we're going to talk about, since the United States Supreme Court is still meeting and debating and deliberating and asking questions about some of the key issues in society, they're in session now. They start out with, oh, yay, oh, yay. That means, I don't know what it means. It means we're going to start. We're going to listen to Sandra Day O'Connor, former woman Supreme Court Justice of the United States Supreme Court, appointed by Ronald Reagan. And she's going to be talking about her book, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. The book is called Out of Order, Stories from the History of the Supreme Court. But she's got some great stories about a woman lawyer that couldn't even get a job when she graduated from law school, and how she went and volunteered and worked herself. You'll hear her talk about that. But she's an incredible woman from Arizona when she got appointed by the Supreme Court. I won't tip you off on that, on how that happened, but it's kind of humorous, actually, how she became a Supreme Court justice, at least how they contacted her about that. You can listen on your computer. We got a blonde joke for tonight, and Lucy's going to do us a blonde joke, and let's see if we can. Lucy, you got that thing ready for us? You do? You don't? You do? You don't? You do? Oh, let's see. Let's try it. It's not working? You recorded it, didn't you? Oh, my. Let's see. I see it right in front of me. There it is. You got it up on the board? It won't select. Isn't that interesting? It will not select. Okay. Lucy, I can't have you read the selection if there isn't any to read. Speak selection. I said it won't do it. Well, isn't that interesting? I'll read you the joke then. A blonde heard that milk bass would make her beautiful. So she left a note for her milkman to leave 15 gallons of milk. When the milkman read the note, he felt there must be a mistake here. He thought she probably meant 1.5 gallons, so he knocked on the door to clarify the point. The blonde came to the door, and the milkman said, "I found your note to leave 15 gallons of milk. Did you mean 1.5 gallons? The blonde said, "I want 15 gallons. I'm going to fill my bathtub up with milk and take a milk bath." The milkman asked, "Do you want it pasteurized?" The blonde said, "No, I just want it up to my shoulders. I can splash it in my eyes." Okay, I can splash it in my eyes. Very good. Very, very good. Ladies and gentlemen, you know that the president made a big speech today about guns and gun control with a background of family members of victims of various shootings across the United States, a lot of them from Sandy Hook. And so we want the Ohio Coalition's message to go out to the criminals, as we've always done. And I'm sure, I'd like to know how many have actually turned in their guns. Mike, since we started playing this, what do you think? Do you think a lot of them have turned in their firearms? We'll play it one more time.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Yes, it certainly is a deadly idea. We wouldn't want anything like that to occur. Well, I think we're reconnected. That's what Audrey just told me. I don't know what's going on with Blog Talk Radio, but we've had several technological problems here over the last 2 months or so. And I don't know what the reason is. Maybe they're getting too busy. Could be. Anyway, we're back on, I believe. It looks like everything's lighted up as it should be. Let's do a quick green tip tonight. You know what the green tip says? If you're taking your kids to school and you got 10 other people you know that drive their kids to school in the morning, why don't you carpool and take one or two cars instead of 8 or 10 cars to go to school? You know, and then you could get one of those Ford, what do you call those things? It's a Ford something. What is that thing called? Ford C-Max. Have you seen the C-Max advertised on television? The C-Max. Are you sitting down? Hold on to your seat. It's just remarkable. The C-Max is a hybrid, gas and electricity. And that hybrid, if you have that baby plugged in and charged up all the way, it will go 21 miles. And then it will switch over to gas. Or you can go on both, but it will go a total of 21 miles. That's the kind of car I've been looking for. that'll at least get me to the grocery store and back. Unbelievable that is actually going on. Well, let's take a real quick look at some news because we need to get to our show since we've lost some time here tonight. But interesting things going on, as always. And the FBI, by the way, is wants the authority to do and the ability to do real-time interception of your Gmail accounts. They can get it later on. They've got the law to do all that, but they want to look at Gmail, Google Voice, and Dropbox in real time. But that may change soon, the trouble they're having, because the Bureau says it's gaining more powers to wiretap all forms of Internet conversation, and cloud storage a top priority for this year. Isn't that just wonderful that the FBI general counsel, he discussed some of these pressing surveillance and national security issues at the American Bar Association last week. And they get the authority for this for the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act 1994, allows the government to force Internet providers and phone companies to install surveillance equipment within their networks. But it doesn't cover email, cloud services, or online chat with providers like Skype. So they're going to expand their authority, and under Title III, they can ask email and online chat providers to furnish the government with technical assistance necessary to accomplish the interception. But it's not going to be long where, hey, we already talked about some of this, 3,100 organizations gathering intelligence, counterintelligence information in the United States, or terrorism information in the United States, so who knows what's actually being collective at this point. But I don't know, having had experience and worked with some people who lived under a totalitarian regime, this is exactly how it clamped down earlier times, but this is how it started, step at a time, do this, do that, do this, do that, and, you know, all of a sudden you wake up and you're living under a dictatorship. Could never happen in America, correct? Probably not. I thought this one was funny. John McCain and Chuck Schumer, Michael Bennett and Jeff Flake, all members of Congress, they were in Nogales, Arizona. They were there, I think, to talk about Mexico. And one of the things they saw while they were standing there, McCain tweeted about it. You have to tweet. They saw a woman climb over an 18-foot fence and cross the border illegally. But they apparently caught her, which was good. I'm sure we catch everyone that tries to go over the border. This is something kind of nice I just heard about this week. It was in the Chronicle Higher Education. Baylor University, that was very famous for its entrepreneurship center in the 1970s, long before other schools had something like that. And when you took this course, this program at Baylor, you had to start a business. And the Baylor's been doing that for 30-some years. And like the founder of People Magazine was a student at Baylor, and he cranked up his course, I mean, his business plan in that course, went out and did it. But now they're doing it with prisoners, and they've been doing it for 9 years. So they have a five-year, one of these guys named Potts, he's halfway through his five-year prison sentence outside of Houston when he heard about the program, and he signed up for it. It's the Prison Entrepreneurship Program, run by a nonprofit of the same name, works with Baylor University's School of Business, and it trains convicted felons to write business plans, market their ideas to investors, and develop workplace skills. I won't go into it in great detail. They've had 850 graduates to this point in the nine-year program, and some of these characters have gone out and started good businesses. Up to 50 students at Baylor participate each semester, visiting prisons and conducting market research for these inmate participants whose own Internet, of course, is restricted. But isn't that a nice idea? And they're teaching this. One of these guys has got a big idea. He's been out, and he has already worked his way up to one of these assistant director of one of these energy companies. Let me see, where was he? Can't find him exactly. Yeah, he's the project manager at a solar power company since he was released from prison in 2010. But isn't that a nice idea? So he's been out 3 years, and he said the entrepreneurship was the kick in the pants that he needed, he says, while serving time for intoxication manslaughter. He said, I had to man up and realize that if I'm going to do this, I'll have to study hard and live with integrity. And he says, you do whatever it takes to never come back here. And he did it. So Baylor's got a great program there. We're doing that. By the way, did you know some of these new state laws, Google Glasses will be out for public consumption, I think, probably here in a month or two. This is where you can actually work your glass, your computer with your eyes by wearing the Google Glass. It's called Google Glass, but they're glasses. And they think that some of the states that say that you can't text message while you're driving, they'll also affect the Google Glasses, and Google's a little worried about that. They don't know what's going to happen about that. Let's have one more thing in the news. The Federal Aviation Administration of this week, they predict that 10,000 commercial drones could be in the sky by 2020 after guidelines are approved. You talk about business opportunities, this could be something. Want to get a drone or two and figure out how to use it and make some money? But I hear people saying that, you know, pizza stores are going to deliver, mail will be sent this way, all kinds of things. So when you see those little set of wings up there in the sky, or big set, whatever they're using, it's going to be something. The FAA has now issued 1,428 licenses to police, universities, and federal agencies, and that's not private. So who knows what's going to go on with the private sector. So drones are here. They're going to be fun to hear about, or they are fun to hear about now, about how we attack people overseas. But when they're flying our skies, it may be an entirely different thing. So make sure your curtains work, because that hawk flying outside your window may, in fact, not be a hawk. It could be a drone watching over you. Well, that's it on the news and that kind of business. And I think what we'll do now is go take a listen to Sandra Day O'Connor. And the last time we used Book TV, it didn't work. And I tried it twice here tonight, and it did. So we're going to listen to Sandra Day O'Connor, former Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, talk about her climb to the Supreme Court and how difficult that was in the early days to be a lawyer and be female. Here we go.
Can you hear? Is it all right? Yes. No? No. Does this have to be turned on, or is, what's the matter? Right into it? Oh, dear. Now can you hear better? I actually didn't get an offer for my first job, so let's just get the introduction changed a little bit. I've happily attended Stanford Law School, and in the process, I met my husband-to-be, John O'Connor, and he was a year behind me in law school. We decided to get married, and I graduated from the law school, and we both liked to eat, and that meant one of us was going to have to work, and since I was out of law school, that was me. And I thought, oh, no problem getting a job. There were at least 40 notices on Stanford's bulletin board at the law school from law firms in California saying Stanford law graduates, we have this, we'd be happy to talk to you about job opportunities. Give us a call. And there were 40 different messages from different law firms in California on the bulletin board. So I called every one of those notices. Not a single one would even give me an interview. I said, why? They said, we don't hire women. And that was the way it was. Now, I got out of law school, I guess, about 1952. But isn't that amazing? They wouldn't even talk. And I really did need to get a job. So I heard that the county attorney in San Mateo County, California, the county seat is in Redwood City, had once had a woman lawyer on his staff. So I thought, well, that's encouraging. I'll go see him. And I made an appointment to see him. In California, they elect the county attorney. And so they're always glad-handers. And he gave me an appointment to see him. And I went to meet him. He was very nice, very agreeable. And he said he had indeed had a woman on his staff at one time. And she did well. And he'd be happy to have another. And I had a good resume, and I'd be fine. But the problem he had was that he got his money from the County Board of Supervisors. And he got only so much money a year. And he had spent his money, and he had no more income for the year. So he was not able to hire anybody else. And he was so sorry, because he felt probably I could be hired, but not without any money. And then he said, also, I'll show you around the office. And he did. And he said, as you can see, I don't have a vacant office to put another deputy. So I had to figure something out. And so I said, well, I understand. I said, I know you don't have any money right now to hire anybody, but I'll work for you for nothing until such time as the supervisors give you a little more money. I said, I'll do that. Well, that kind of took his breath away. And then I said, and I met your secretary. She's very nice. There's room in her office to put a second desk if she wouldn't object. And that was my first job as a lawyer. No pay, and I put my desk in with the secretary. But I loved my job. It was so interesting. I just liked everything I got to do. It was very exciting for me. And so that's what I did. And it worked out fine. And I don't remember now how long I was there before he managed to find a little money in his account with the county. And until I think somebody, one of the deputies must have left for another job and it opened an office. So everything turned out all right. But it was pretty tough sledding getting that first job. And I felt sorry for the other women who were in law school and getting out and looking for work, because there was no real opportunity for women lawyers at that time. I'm reading the new book out by, what's her name, Sharon, who? Yeah, I've been reading that. And it's a good story. You better read it too. But it's amazing how things have changed. And I'm very glad that I was able to be a little bit of that change in America for women. And I was working happily along in my jobs in Arizona when I was sitting at, I had become a judge on the Court of Appeals. And I was in my office one afternoon, and the telephone rang, and I answered, and the operator said, this is the White House calling. Is Justice O'Connor there? I was a justice at that point on the Arizona Court. And I said, yes. And they said, well, it's the president calling. Would you put her on? So I said, well, this is she. And I, hello. And it was Ronald Reagan on the phone. And he said, Sandra? I mean, how about that? First name basis. So I said, yes, Mr. President. He said, I'd like to announce your nomination tomorrow for the Supreme Court. Is that okay with you? Now, that's quote, unquote, what happened. And I kind of gulped, and I said, well, yes, Mr. President, I think it is. And so that's what happened. He had sent three people from the Attorney General's office out to Arizona to check on my record. I had served in some capacity or the other in all three branches of Arizona's state government in the preceding years. And, of course, I'd left some kind of a track record behind. And I think the president had sent people out to uncover press coverage of anything that I had been involved with and to look at papers in connection with my record. And I guess they hadn't uncovered anything that looked scary. So he decided to do that. And I was at home the day they wanted to come out and really talk to me. And my husband and I had built a sun-dried adobe house in the Phoenix area when we moved there in 1957. Now, that was a real challenge because you can buy burnt adobes. They're sold commonly. But in this country today, it's very hard to go buy sun-dried adobes. Those are the adobe bricks that somebody has made and then dried them in a frame in the sun until they're dry and fairly firm. And that's what we wanted to use. And I met a man who lived on Cattle Track Road in Scottsdale, and he built some sun-dried adobe houses. And he could tell us how to get some sun-dried adobe. So we followed his advice and got some and found a starving young architect who was willing to design a house, even if it was with sun-dried adobes. And so we got this house built. And I just loved it. It was so fun. Until you've seen and touch sun-dried adobe, you probably can't appreciate why I liked it so much. But it looks good, it feels good, and it's wonderful in Arizona sunshine. It really is. So that's what we used to build our house, and I loved it very much. And when the president made his call and I agreed to come back to Washington, D.C., we learned that housing prices in D.C. are very high. So we had to sell our little sun-dried adobe house and raise a little money so we could get something to live in D.C. And we did. And that was painful to have that happen. And an interesting thing has happened since. And I'm wandering from my topic, but it's kind of interesting to hear. We have formed now in Arizona a program using our old house. And so it's been purchased back by a nonprofit little organization to support the O'Connor House. And we use it as a place where civil talk leads to civic action. And I like that because in the years... It's what we need a lot more of. Congress needs that. State legislatures need it. And when I had that house, when my husband and I were living in it and I was a legislative leader, I would cook some Mexican food of some kind, chalupas or something that stays hot on the low burner of the stove. And I'd buy some cold beer, and then I'd invite the key people on both sides of the aisle in the legislature and just have them come over to have a bite to eat and a beer. And when you sit around like that and speak casually in a friendly manner, as you would with your own friends or acquaintances at your own house, you just feel better about knowing people and relating to them. And we were able to make friends enough that we could solve the state's problems. It worked. And that's what I'd like to see more of. And at present, we're using O'Connor House to get legislators together over beers and chalupas and see if they can't get acquainted with each other and solve some of Arizona's problems. And I think it's working. So that's the effort, you know. And what I felt when I was in my years at the court before I retired was that we were failing to teach young people in this country anything about how our government operates, how it runs. Two-thirds of high school grads today score below proficiency on any kind of civics test. Only one-third of Americans can name the three branches of government, let alone say what they do. I mean, imagine that. Only 27% can identify the purpose of the U.S. Constitution. And it's right there in the title. Now, less than one-fifth of high school seniors can explain how citizen participation helps democracy. Only 22% of eighth graders can name any purpose met by the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, that's very painful for me. Among 14,000 seniors in college, which participated in a survey, the average score on the civics exam was just barely over 50%. That's an F. Now, this lack of knowledge does lead to disengagement. About half of the 14-year-olds in the United States say that their political attitude is indifferent or alienated. They have no interest. And I just think that we have to reverse that. We ought to care about that in this country. When our Constitution was adopted, we didn't have public schools in America. That came later. In fact, it was about 30 years after the Constitution was adopted that people began to say we need some schools in this country to teach the young people how this new government of ours works, how it's supposed to work, and how they're part of it. Well, they were right. We did need to educate the young people. And that's what started public schools. And today, we are having public schools that no longer teach civics. They don't require them for high school graduation classes in civics. They're barely taught. I don't know about you, but when I went to school, I went to grade school and high school in El Paso, Texas. I grew up on a ranch. It was too far from town to go to school. And my parents sent me off to El Paso, where I had maternal grandparents living. And so I took my schooling there. And we had civics all the time. I got sick and tired of it, to tell you the truth. But I think that's a lot better than having none. And so I was very concerned at the time when I announced my retirement about the lack of any nationwide attention to the teaching of civics. And so I decided that in my retirement that I'd have time to do a little volunteer work and maybe I could get started a plan to teach civics. And so I started something that we call iCivics. Now, we have iPads and iPods and iEverything, so I thought iCivics would be good, and it is. And we got it going, and what I did was assemble the most wonderful group of teachers who really know the subjects and what these young people, particularly in middle school up to first year high school, should know about civics. And so with their help and with the help of some experts in writing up exams and things, we put together the iCivics website. And what we do is create games on the website. It's www.littleicivics.org. I want you to look at it, so don't forget it. I'll remind you again what it is so you can write it down. But we have games on it that the young people play, and they're fun to play. We have now, I think, about 19 up, and it's great fun. The young people will get on it, and they'll stay on it all night until their parents say, now go to bed, turn that off, go to bed. And it's terrific. Teachers who have started using it at school find that it's very satisfactory. The main problem today is that most of the schools don't list civics anymore as a subject to be taught, so it makes it harder for the teachers to find time to teach civics. But that's been my major effort since stepping down from the court, is to start and continue and expand the teaching of iCivics. And we now have a minimum of 30,000 young people a day who are plugged into iCivics. I want a lot more than that. That's just the start, but it's extremely effective. Baylor University in Texas did a study of it and took the program and put it in 3 or 4 schools in the area in Texas, somewhat near Baylor, and left it in place for a while and then tested the students. And Baylor came back with not a good review, a rave review. They said it's incredible, that it really is effective. And so that's my major effort now. That's how I'm spending my time as a retired justice, except that I also sit occasionally with some of the federal courts of appeal. Now, you know the federal court system. It consists of district courts where trials in federal cases are tried. And then if the loser appeals, the appeal goes to a federal court of appeals. And we have a number of federal circuit courts of appeal. They're scattered around the country. And I volunteer to sit with some of those courts of appeal. And then if you lose there, your only application for relief is with the U.S. Supreme Court. And their grant of jurisdiction is discretionary with the court, and not too many cases are granted. So that's how the system works today. And I volunteer periodically to sit on one of the federal courts of appeal and hear a number of cases for 2 or 3 days. And today, I went to the Supreme Court myself. I was here, and I heard a case argued, and it just happened to be a case which I had heard as a volunteer judge when I sat on the Ninth Circuit some months back and heard that case, and we rendered a decision, and the losers didn't like the result, and they filed a petition with the U.S. Supreme Court, which took the case, and it was argued today. So I had the pleasure of sitting in the courtroom and listening to the lawyers argue about the case that I had participated in deciding some months before at the Court of Appeals level. So that was kind of fun to do, I have to say. And I think what we've done tonight is to see if you didn't have various questions that you thought you might like me to talk about. And we'll try some of them. If they don't go so well, I'll go back and abandon those and just start.
All right, Justice, I have some of the questions here.
I'm not having to spur my hand.
As you say, Your Honor. I've asked it not to interrupt a while and ask you this question. Could you describe what you were thinking or feeling the first and or last time you walked through the curtain to take your place on the court bench?
Well, the first time was pretty scary. The last time, you're used to it. But the first time was really amazing. And I couldn't believe that I was, in fact, now sitting as a member of the U.S. Supreme Court, a court that had never before had a woman on its panel of judges. And that was a very special event for the court, and I think it's made a difference. When I visit the court today, as I did today, and look up at that bench, I see 3 women sitting there. There are also 6 men, but the overall effect is a lot better.
They gave me my own mic here. Are there any traditions or rituals that go on behind the scenes at the court and that you are fond of?
Oh, yes. Well, I'll start with the first. It is the practice at the court when you meet each day to go on the bench or to sit and discuss cases for each justice to shake hands with every other justice. Now, that is really special. I don't know how you feel about it, but to shake hands with someone, now come on over here. Yeah, okay. To shake hands with someone is meaningful. It really is. I mean, you touch their hand and you shake them, and it's much more effective then to work together as a court and decide the cases. And that was just marvelous. But on that first day, come back, one of the justices was a justice. His name, he was a former major athlete, and he took my hand, and I thought I was going to die. I mean, honestly, tears sprang out of my eyes. There was nothing I could do. He killed me. It was Byron White. Now, do you remember who he was? My God, he was a professional football player, and I don't know what else. He was amazing. But he about killed me. And so I learned what to do. Give me your hand. See what I'm doing? I grabbed his thumb. And I did that for the remaining years that he and I were both on that court.
I think I'll stand back here.
Self-protection.
Do you think female judges have a unique perspective? If so, in what way and how does it influence?
No, I don't think they do, really. I mean, overall, male or female, as a justice, you've gone to law school, you've studied law, and you've had some experience, maybe as a trial judge or a state judge or in your law practice, something. And so you come there with some experience that is shared with the men who've done the same thing. So I don't think you come in with some preset attitude or experience that's vastly different from that of all the other justices. I really don't. Now, it could be at some stage of the of some proceeding that as a former wife and mother, I might look at some domestic relations case with somewhat different views than maybe a justice who has never been married or had children. That's possible. But I don't think by and large that you find many with totally different approaches.
Do you think cameras should be allowed in the court while cases are being argued?
That question is posed about once a year to members of the Supreme Court, I guess largely by media people who are accustomed to covering events of courts. And so far, the Supreme Court has not permitted cameras to come into the Supreme Court chamber. It probably doesn't matter much as a practical matter because by nighttime, every day that cases are heard at the court, you can get a full transcript of everything that was said that day in the courtroom by the lawyers and the judges, the justices. It's all transcribed and available and in writing. So it's completely available almost immediately. And I don't think that the absence of seeing that on a television screen as opposed to reading it in whatever form it comes out is that significant. People are accustomed in this country to seeing everything on the television, so it's a little frustrating, I guess, for some to think it isn't there. But I don't think it's a cause for major concern because of the fact that, in fact, it is there in writing. You can see what was said.
What advice would you give a young female attorney interested in becoming a judge?
Oh, well, if you want to be a judge, first of all, you've got to be a pretty good law student. You really need to prove that in law school and elsewhere, you've established a record as someone who does understand and know legal principles and who can write well. That's very important because as a judge, you're probably going to have to write your opinions and express yourself well. So that's important, and you want to be able to demonstrate based on articles that you've written and published or books you've written and published, that you have some capacity to understand legal issues and to write about them. I think that's very helpful in the selection of an appellate court judge.
The court has had its moments of partisanship dating back to the beginning. Do you feel, looking back at recent history, that is, back to World War II, that partisanship is causing uncivility today?
Well, I don't think it's as bad as it maybe was at earlier times in the nation's history. I really don't. When you look back in the early days of the country at Thomas Jefferson and some of the things that went on in the court when he was there, when John Marshall was our Chief Justice, they were second cousins, approximately, maybe second once removed. I'm not sure. They were cousins, but they weren't the kissing kind. They did not like each other. It was really unpleasant. And yet they had many issues to resolve that affected our nation. And it's amazing that we got through all those days and did well. We don't have anything like that today. We have many cases where the justices may end up disagreeing on the bottom line. You're not going to find it 9-0 every time, once in a while. But usually there's some division of opinion on the court, and that's very normal. But in the early days of the country, there was some real hostility among some of the justices, I'm sorry to say.
What's the number one question the other female justices have asked you about being on the Supreme Court?
They haven't asked me anything. They just go to work and do it.
What should they ask you?
I don't think there's anything they should ask me. Maybe how the lunchroom works and how they can get better lunches or something. That would be the only kind of thing I could help them with, probably.
Was there any decision you made that, based on how it was interpreted or otherwise followed up, that you now wish you had voted differently on?
I don't look back. Now, that's one thing I have learned in life, and that is to do the very best you can every day with whatever problems you have and are required to decide, make a decision, and then don't look back. I don't look back. I'm sure I've made plenty of mistakes, but I don't need to look back at them. I've been there, done that.
Here's another advice question. Based on the state of the current job market, what advice would you give someone considering law school?
Well, I'm going to tell them that they won't perhaps immediately have the kind of job they'd like, because it seems to me there are more lawyers available for hire than there are jobs available for lawyers. And it's tougher to get a job now as a lawyer right now than it used to be. So it may be a more challenging choice of a place to work. I'm sure it will even out over time, but if I were being asked that by someone who's in law school today, I would tell them not to rush to get out because they might have a hard time getting a job.
Now, in cases that depend on science and technology expertise, how do you identify and then find such expertise?
Well, I don't have to do that as the judge. I only have to decide each case based on the evidence presented to the court. And in the case of an appellate court, which the Supreme Court is, the evidence has been introduced and presented at the trial court level. In the first court to hear the case, that's where the evidence comes in. And it's a matter of record. It's in the record on that case. So if you want to look back as the appellate court judge at what was in the record at the time the case was resolved, it's all there in writing. It's all there in the record. And you don't have to fish around, and you're limited to deciding it based on what is in the record.
Will any of the stories in this book make it into your iCivics curriculum?
Oh, in the new book?
Yes.
Well, I doubt it, or I might have put it in already. I don't think so. No, no, I don't think so.
Well, she's a very interesting woman, and certainly talented, articulate, intelligent, and we look forward to hearing more from her. I think this is her second book, perhaps her third. But anyway, she's certainly in good health, and her mind is really working good, and she can really talk before a crowd. All right, that's it for tonight. We'll see you next week, and we'll ask Vera Lynn to sign us off, as she usually does, singing "We'll Meet Again."
Again, don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.